Matrisneha.
Matrisneha.
By affection for his mother.
By affection for his mother.
Vasha Anugaha.
Vasha Anugaha.
Being compelled.
Being compelled.
Translation. Although offering clarified butter into the sacrificial fire in the name of the demigods, without the knowledge of the demigods, he also offered oblations to the demons because they were his relatives through his mother. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Because of Vishwarupa's affection for the families of both the demigods and the demons, he appeased the Supreme Lord on behalf of both dynasties. When he offered oblations in the fire on behalf of the Asuras, he did so secretly without knowledge of the demigods. So here we see the last two verses. It says that on Vishwarupa's father's side, his father is Tvasta. So he offered oblations loud and in the open, and when he performed the sacrifice, Indraya idam swaha idam agnaye, and so on, to the demigods. But then covertly, that is to say in secret, he also made oblations to the demons. It says here, because of affection for his mother, it says, Matri Sneha, affection for his mother. Well, it says earlier that his mother, whose name is Rachana, it says Rachana, the daughter of the Daichas, she's called Daicha Atmaja, daughter of a demon. So they're mixed marriage, somehow or other. Rachana, the daughter of the Daichas, became the wife of Prajapati Tvashta. By his Simana, he begot in her womb two very powerful sons named Sannivesha and Vishwarupa. So that was the situation. So his mother was the daughter of a demon. So therefore, because of affection to his mother, he was also partial. Remember that Brahma had recommended to Indra that they accept Vishwarupa as their guru, but they would have to tolerate his partiality to the demons. So because of his family ties. So here in this chapter, we find out that Indra was not able to take this advice and didn't tolerate partiality. So he discovered this, as we'll see. He was offering not only to Indra but to the other side as well. In this way, when he offered oblations in the fire on behalf of the Asuras, he did so secretly without the knowledge of the demigods. So that's what Vishwarupa was doing here in this fire. I don't know how much really there is to say about this purport. This activity takes place. Indra, as we shall see, actually, Indra, who is the king of heaven, Sura Ishwara, he's called Sureshwara. That's the name for Indra, Sura Ishwara. That means he's the king of the suras, of the demigods. But these are engaged in sense gratification. The demigods are described as Sakama devotees. That is, they're devotees of Krishna. But they have material desires, Sakama. So because of that, sometimes they also act in demoniac ways, even though they're devotees. But it means that although they have material desires, still they uphold the rule of Vishnu, and they try to gratify their desires in lawful ways. So even though there's some sense of supremacy or independence from Krishna, that is there, because they're interested in sense gratification, still on the whole, they are his servants. And they recognize his rule. They belong to the bureaucracy of Krishna for management of the universal affairs. We see that the Supreme Absolute Truth is a person, and therefore there are people everywhere. Things do not run impersonally. Everywhere we see there's organization, that there's people behind it. We may turn on the light switch and electricity comes, and it comes down wires, and there's transformers, and these come from a place where there's a power station, but ultimately there's some person who's running the show. So this whole city has various departments: electricity, gas, water and sewage, and so on. And they're all being run, each department has its head. And then there's a government, and there's a head of the government, and so on. It's this way here because this is the way the whole universe is run. Human life or human affairs is not some big anomaly, as is thought by the modern material scientists. They think that this is something strange. Generally, the feeling is that what we see of human life is something different in the universe. The universe is operating under the law of entropy. That is, as time goes on, disorder increases. And that's normally what we see. This is called entropy. And things, energy dissipates. That is to say, if you have something hot and you have something cold and you put them close together, they'll both reach a neutral level of the same tendency. You don't usually see that when you have something that's lukewarm, that gradually over the course of time, one part becomes hot and the other part becomes cold. Not unless there's something else working. What you see is they come to a neutral level. So this tendency of things to run down is called entropy. So from contrasts of energy states to each one uniform state of neutral energy, where there's no contrast and therefore no activities, or for order or organization to decay. This is entropy, known in our terminology as the predominance of the mode of ignorance. Well, anyway, according to science, the whole universe is going on this process of entropy. But then you see, as they see it in our universe, there's increase of order. Opposite is happening on our planet anyway. Of course, they see the thing as coming by through evolution, but there's to see there's organization that takes place, things going more organized, higher and higher states of organization and energy. So what they say is that somewhere in this vast entropy there's an anti-entropic branch system. How it happens, they don't know. But that's, so we're a big exception to the rule of the universe. It's just somehow or other there that you get this temporary anti-entropic branch system budding out somehow or other, where there's a temporary, causeless apparently, anti-entropic branch system. But actually the fact is that wherever there's organization and order, there's intelligence behind it. It does not a big exception to the rule. Actually, our human organization is a symptom of organization anywhere. Prabhupada offered this once as an argument for the existence of God. He said, anywhere there's organization, you need a leader. Groups of people don't self-organize. There has to be a leader to give directions. So we can understand that the universe also has its leader. The same principles apply throughout. So, our principle is that demigods, people who are running things, and among those, there's leaders. And ultimately, there's one supreme leader, and that's Krishna. So this is the symptoms of the demigods. More powerful, conditioned, living entities. So similarly also demons. Their opponents. While the demigods want to help manage the universe on behalf of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even though they have the enjoying propensity, still they're pious. So pious means that they recognize the laws of God. So demons means that they don't recognize any laws but their own. And without any reference, they just want to take it over. Displace the demigods, it's their big thing. To displace them, and challenge them, and run it themselves. So this competition, as we see, has been going on almost from the very beginning of creation. So those that are who are for and those who are against Krishna. And they're people. We heard Kirtanananda trying to explain on television when he was asked, why are people against you? And so he described that there are people against you. And then the guy said, well, these are bad people. He says, no, I don't want to call anyone bad, he said, after describing people as being bad. He said, I don't want to call anyone bad. He said, but there's a force of badness, he said, that controls people just as there's a force of goodness. So he seemed to put forces, impersonal forces. So he doesn't want to call anyone bad. He's just saying that they're people who are under the control of the force of badness. Just as other people are in control of the force of goodness. Well, there are people there, actually. There's demons and there's demigods. These are there. He sort of wants to have the old duality without being judgmental, I suppose, or appearing to be. So therefore you relate to everything to forces. The dark side of the force and so on, as they said in that movie, Star Wars. Yeah, it sounds like Star Wars went over to the dark side of the force. There's people throughout there, although there's not one big anti-God. According to Christian thinking, it seems like they think there's one big demon, Satan, who's so powerful as to practically amount to a second god. And indeed, there was a group of people called Manichaeans. Manichaean, there was a called the Manichaean heresy that explained that there were ultimately two gods, a god of light and a god of darkness. And they were fighting it out for control of the universe. And St. Augustine, before he became a Christian, was a Manichaean. Many people feel he imported a little of that dualism into Christianity. So anyway, there's Satan, who amounts to a separate God. If you start to talk to Christian theologians who are a little subtle, they realize that Satan couldn't be doing anything unless he was actually doing under the sanction of God, and so in some way he was fulfilling God's plan. He doesn't have any independent existence. But anyway, so far as we know from the Vedas, there's no one big demon like that, one big anti-God. But there are a lot of demons working together in concert, in conspiracy, somehow or other, trying to act to undermine the rule of the demigods. So that goes on. Prabhupada sometimes uses the term demigod and devotee as simultaneous terms. But we should understand that this platform, this Sakama platform, is not very... it's a risky platform to be on, because we can see how people like Indra, as we're going to find out in the story, sometimes act like demons. What we'll see is that in the pastime of Indra and the demon Vritrasura, when you come down to it, Vritrasura turns out to be the effective devotee, and Indra turns out to be the effective demon. Of the two, Vritrasura is more advanced in Krishna consciousness than Indra is, as it will happen. And of course, Indra also at one point challenged Krishna. So the point is, of course, is that he can, when push comes to shove, he finally accepts the supremacy of Krishna, even though sometimes he has this tendency to stray from this path. Anyway, the Sakama devotee platform is not really meant for us in the Krishna consciousness movement, because this Krishna consciousness movement, a little specialized, it's meant to produce pure devotees, not Sakama devotees. This is what Lord Chaitanya has to offer. So the vows that we take and the practices that are given to us by Srila Prabhupada are meant for Paramahamsas, not for mere people like Indra or so on. So our material desires in themselves are symptomatic of the rebelliousness of the living entity against the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I have any material desire. I may satisfy that desire in a lawful way, that is to say, according to the prescribed limits set down by Krishna, and therefore it's pious. So it may be pious. But still, ultimately, that piety too is condemned by Krishna when ultimately he says, sarva dharmam parityaja. That dharma you may give up is that conventional religious piety. And explicitly in Bhagavatam, this platform is rejected. Dharma kaitava projita. Dharma projita kaitavata. He's rejecting these materially motivated religions. And when Narada Muni speaks to Vyasadeva, he rebukes him for including in his transmission of the Vedic literature all this Kaitava Dharma. He says that you've propagated restricted sense gratification, but all you're doing is teaching people sense gratification in the name of religion. He said, you've taught sense gratification with prohibitions, but he said, in the Kali Yuga, people will not care for the prohibitions. And that's precisely what happens. So that all the institutions of restricted sense gratification are starting to break down in Kali Yuga. One of the first ones being a license to eat meat, because meat eating is licensed in Vedic culture. License means permitted under restriction. When you license something, that means you permit it, but that it's restricted in some way or another. So there's a license to eat meat in Vedic culture, and that license is you can perform sacrifice of certain kinds and therefore eat meat. So usually that's being done because people think that if we don't license it, then it'll go on anyway and we'll have no control whatsoever. Right now there's a big discussion in the United States, for example, whether to license illicit drugs. Some people think that the only solution to the problem is to legalize marijuana, cocaine, whatever. Because then at least we can have some control over it. And the present state of affairs is being compared to prohibition. Prohibition is considered to be one of the big failures. What was it, the 19th Amendment? The Constitution, in an excess of piety, everybody voted to outlaw, make illegal alcoholic beverages in the United States. But almost as soon as the law was passed, people made arrangements for illegally accepting these drugs. And then some criminal empires begin to flourish because all these people become very rich, who were willing to manufacture and smuggle alcoholic beverages because there was a huge demand for it. People weren't really willing to give it up, even though they voted for it. The laws were not rigorously enforced enough, and so criminal empires built up. And so it's considered now that prohibition just contributed to crime. I think, however, that's the general image of prohibition. If you probably look at it, I've seen statistics that the amount of deaths in the United States are attributable to alcohol, either from persons, what they do to your physical symptoms, also murders, also automobile accidents, all dramatically declined during prohibition. It wasn't that it didn't work. It had a very good effect. But it may not have been a failure. It's generally regarded as a failure, but that's because... Anyway, now people are comparing the present... So now let's legalize these other drugs, like we've legalized alcohol, but do it under license it with all these restrictions, so then we can control it. At least we'll stop all these criminal enterprises and so on. So this is sometimes the system is used. So the Vedas do that also with meat eating. Some people are going to eat meat anyway, so we'll license it under certain restrictions, which will discourage it. People will gradually learn. And so on. This was the system. So Narada Muni told Vyasadeva, they'll not care for your restrictions. That's the problem. It's like alcohol has so many restrictions. Now you have to be 21. And still, so many people under 21 are drinking. Big problem, alcohol consumption in high school. Everybody manages
Cigarettes are also sold under restriction, but still they manage to get around. Pornography is restricted, still it manages to get around. So these restrictions, people find ways to get around them. And as time goes on, they do more and more. So actually, ultimately, he doesn't approve of this system of licensed sense gratification. So that's actually, licensed sense gratification is not really so much our business in Krishna consciousness movement. Our business following Lord Chaitanya, what Prabhupada presents, is a movement to do something really revolutionary, which is to create a movement of pure devotees. And that's actually what this Krishna consciousness is about. Paramahamsas. That's what Bhagavatam is meant for. Paramahamsas. It's not for fruitive actors. It's for people who understand, who have in their hearts this desire, that I would like to give up sense gratification whatsoever. My goal is not the higher planets. My goal is the kingdom of God. Yet that's a very hard goal to maintain. I know many, many people who are devotees of Krishna, who chant the Hare Krishna mantra, and given the choice, to go to Svargaloka, say, with the apsaras and everything that's available there, and Goloka Vrindavan, if you put some meter to measure their emotional responses, rather than saying what they think they ought to say, much more attracted to Svargaloka. Many of us would be attracted because the desires are there in the heart. And then we say, the desire would be, honestly, first I'd like to go to Svargaloka for a while, and then after that, Goloka Vrindavan later. Because Goloka Vrindavan is just like Krishna book, that's all. There's no sense of it's all hearing and chanting about Krishna. There's no sense gratification there. And the more powerful attraction is for pious sense gratification. Licensed, restricted, but very powerful sense gratification that's available on the higher planets. So I think one thing this movement is doing is producing a lot of demigods, or people who will go to the higher planets. But that's not our purpose. That's just a side effect, if anything. And it's said that people will go to the higher planets if, after a practice of devotional service, one still has material desires. That's where he goes. If he dies after fairly short practice, he'll go to the higher planets, he'll enjoy there for a long time, then come back down and take birth in a family of pious people or wealthy people, and have the opportunity again to pick up. So it's a consolation prize for having failed in Krishna consciousness. But if that's what the desires are in the heart, that's where it will go. But that's not what this movement is for. Now, everywhere there are people practicing religions of restricted sense gratification, although they'll not achieve very much even with that. But our business is really, our vows and our mission is to attain pure devotional service. So we should not be satisfied with this restricted sense gratification. Yeah. what we need in at this point in Kali Yuga is pure devotional service. The platform of pious or restricted sense gratification is always shaky. There's that purport at the end of, what is it, the fourth chapter, where Krishna says that in the Vedas there are regulated, there are injunctions that control attachment and aversion to the sense objects. But one should not fall under the sway of such attachment and aversion. So Prabhupada has this purport there about restricted sense gratification. I just read it a little while ago, you may remember. You know what I'm talking about? You remember it, Thakur? Why don't you hand me a Bhagavad Gita? And Prabhupada said that this is a dangerous position. He said, even on the royal road, he says, there are accidents. Even on the best maintained highway, there are accidents. It's not the fourth chapter. The third. Find it now. Anyway, I can't remember how the Sanskrit begins.
It's a verse about embodied beings feel attraction and repulsion to the sense objects, but one should avoid because there's something blocks on the path of self-realization.
I'm not sure. Where's that? I thought it was in the fourth chapter.
How he Mari Panti now is one of the.
No, that's not it.
That's not it. Once you avoid the stunning in the life.
Now I've lost it. I could find in the other one. This doesn't have a right index. Anyway, Prabhupada gives the example that there may be some license for sense gratification, but that actually it's better not to take advantage of it or depend too heavily on it, because, he says, even on the royal road, as you say, the well-maintained interstate highway, there can be accidents. So it's always a dangerous position to be into. So that should be our goal in Krishna consciousness. We're being offered something very, very high, something higher than maybe what we may want on a day-to-day basis. But actually we should take advantage of it, because it's being given here. And no one else has giving away. This is Krishna Prema Pradaya. This Lord Chaitanya is Krishna Prema Prada. He gives away Krishna Prema. So otherwise, people give away so many things. But this is what Lord Chaitanya is specifically coming to give, Krishna Prema, a pure love of Krishna, which is the highest goal and therefore satisfies everyone. Was that it, the one you were talking about?
Yeah.
I didn't recognize it. Oh, it's in the third chapter, 334. Oh yeah, Tao Hiyasya. Yeah. There are principles to regulate. This is the way it's been translated now. There are principles to regulate attachment and aversion pertaining to the senses and their objects. That means the Vedas. One should not come under the control of such attachment and aversion because they are stumbling blocks on the path of self-realization. He says, those who are in Krishna consciousness are naturally reluctant to engage in material sense gratification, but those who are not in such consciousness should follow the rules and regulations of the revealed scriptures. So it depends. You see, two levels. Those who are actually Krishna conscious, they don't want to engage in any material sense gratification. But if we're not in Krishna consciousness, then we should follow the rules and regulations of the revealed scriptures. Unrestricted sense enjoyment is the cause of material engagement. But one who follows the rules and regulations of the revealed scriptures does not become entangled by sense objects. For example, sex enjoyment is a necessity for the conditioned soul, and sex enjoyment is allowed under the license of marriage ties. See the word license, how he's using it? The license of marriage ties. According to scriptural injunctions, one is forbidden to engage in sex relations with any woman other than one's wife. All other women are considered as one's mother. But in spite of such injunctions, a man is still inclined to have sex relationships with other women. This goes on all the time. The institution of adultery, which is standard procedure, apparently. These propensities are to be curbed, otherwise there will be stumbling blocks in the path of self-realization. As long as the material body is there, the necessities of material body are allowed, but under rules and regulations. Then he says, but, and yet, we should not rely upon the control of such allowances. See, that shouldn't be our basis. Why is that? One has to follow those rules or regulations unattached to them. Because practice of sense gratification under regulations may also lead one to go astray, as much as there is always the chance of an accident even on the royal road. So even if it's licensed, even if it's okay, one should not become attached. See, that's not a sufficient condition to say it's all right. I can have so much sense gratification. A person, for example, may overindulge in eating prasadam. Well, it's all right. It's prasadam. It's offered to Krishna. I can fill my belly three times over. I can enjoy opulent foodstuff. But if one becomes attached, and in that way gradually, over the course of time, doesn't try to control senses, even with prasadam, then someday may come when there's no prasadam available, and the tongue is out of control, and then we'll fall down and eat unoffered or unofferable foodstuff, just out of see what I mean? Because there's no attempt. Because one has simply relied on allowances. As much as there is always the chance of an accident, even on the royal roads. Although they may be very carefully maintained, no one can guarantee that there will be no danger even on the safest road. The sense enjoyment spirit has been current a very long, long time owing to material association. Therefore, in spite of regulated sense enjoyment, there is every chance of falling down. Therefore, any attachment for regulated sense enjoyment must also be avoided by all means. That's what Krishna is saying in this verse. Yes, there is allowed, regulated sense enjoyment is allowed. But if we become attached to that, that even though it's pious to be so, it's still dangerous. And so what's the solution? Well, that's what was offered by Narada Muni. You have to present Srimad Bhagavatam, he's saying to Vyasadeva. Only by giving people full information about the all-attractive Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna will you be able to draw people away from their attachment even to regulated sense gratification. As Prabhupada says here, but attachment to Krishna consciousness, or acting always in the loving service of Krishna, detaches one from all kinds of sensory activity. Therefore, no one should try to be detached from Krishna consciousness at any stage of life. So the principle is to become attached to Krishna consciousness at any stage of life. So that attachment to the activities of Krishna consciousness is there. Gradually one can become detached from sense enjoyment. The whole purpose of detachment from all kinds of sense attachment is ultimately to become situated on the platform of Krishna consciousness. That's what is wanted. So if it's a high level, high goal that we have in mind, very, very high, to become completely detached from all sense gratification, we can also understand that it's also given into us in a way that's easy. As Prabhupada says about Krishna consciousness, it's simultaneously easy and sublime. By sublime, it means it takes you as far as you can go, to the highest goal, beyond which there's nothing higher. But at the same time, it's easy. That it's possible, just by being engaged faithfully in the activities of Krishna consciousness, to over all kinds of material attachments. They'll go away. So this is how we can get off of this Sakama devotee platform. That's a very risky platform, and especially for us, because we come from demoniac backgrounds and have demoniac association and live in demoniac environment, that it's very, very dangerous. There's no place of pious sense gratification. Almost all sense gratification tends to become very quickly unrestricted by nature of the surroundings and what's available in our culture. So it's not a safe platform at all. Practically the royal road doesn't exist anymore for us.
It's a royal road.
Yeah, sometimes it is. So we shouldn't try to be demigods. We should try to become pure devotees. If we don't make it, well, that's another thing. We will eventually. But that should be our aim always. That's what this Krishna consciousness movement is for. Other people can take care of the other parts. We have to. This is what is being offered. This incomparable gift, Krishna prema, that's being offered by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Therefore, most munificent of all incarnations. We don't have to try to bring him down to some other more convenient level. We should try to come up to accept the gift that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has offered. There may not be ultimately many takers, but Prabhupada has already noted that if you sell diamonds, you'll not expect everyone will be able to purchase. And it's better that we remain small and unpopular, but pure, then we become very large and very popular at the cost of that spiritual purity. If we have to choose between one or the other, we shouldn't compromise for the sake of becoming more broadly accepted. Srila Prabhupada never, ever did that. Okay, any questions, comments? Dear?
Actually, at one point, Prabhupada said, we already have enough devotees. Now we just have to boil the milk and make sure the devotees we have are pure. We don't need any more devotees.
Yeah. He said that. It's true.
Mm-hmm. In Krishna consciousness, we also use our senses to engage in Krishna service. So what does it mean to control the senses?
We already use our senses in Krishna service? That's what it means to control the senses. Use your senses in Krishna service.
But isn't that even shadowing of Krishna's?
Well, if you eat too much prasadam, then you're not really using your senses in the optimal way in Krishna's service, because then if you eat too much prasadam, then the time you could be serving Krishna, you're going to be sleeping it off, for example. Or you have to spend time running to reduce your weight. You could be doing some service and so on. So the idea is that I take enough prasadam to keep my body healthy and functioning well for Krishna service. But if I take too much, then I'm going to have to, my service will suffer.
And this applies at all times.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
About
yeah.
If we don't see Krishna.